Okay, we are going to make a major leap in the Psalms. We were in Psalm 3 last week. We are now going to be in Psalm 4.
Wow.
I felt the earth move.
this music stand was up too late last night. Okay, lesson one. The title is Do Unto Others. And when you read the psalm, it won't make sense that it would be that title. Hopefully we'll get to the point where it does make sense. Psalm 4. It's a short psalm. So we're going to read the whole thing. And I'll read it at the beginning of each lesson, new lesson on Psalm 4. And by the time we're done, I will have read it 15 times.
For 8 verses.
Yeah. Psalm 4. It says, it begins. Now remember, Psalm 3 referred to, there was a title for Psalm 3. It says, A Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom. The title here to Psalm 4 is, To the Choir Master with Stringed Instruments, simply A Psalm of David. It says, Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have given me relief when I was in distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. O men, how long shall my honor be turned into shame? And how long will you love vain words and seek after lies? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. Be angry and do not sin. Ponder in your own hearts, on your beds, and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and put your trust in the Lord. There are many who say to you, Who will show us some good? Lift up the light of your face upon us, O Lord. You have put more joy in my heart than they have when their grain and wine abound. In peace I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. Now, there isn't, because as you noted, I began by reading the title to both Psalm 3 and Psalm 4. While there was a historical setting for Psalm 3, there isn't one set out for Psalm 4. However, some commentators do link Psalm 3 and 4 together. And say that it is actually intended to be included within the same setting as the revolt of Absalom, his son. And part of that would be because it's obvious from reading Psalm 4 that, again, David is in some distress. He was in Psalm 3 in great distress. We mentioned that Psalm 3 was probably the greatest crisis of David's life, when his own son rebelled against him with the intention of removing him from the throne. And unfortunately for David, one of the problems with being king is you can't be voted out of office. So I remember seeing a cartoon one time of the king standing in the window above his drawbridge, and there was a mob with a battering ram coming against there, and he turned to one of his ministers and said, I wish this were a democracy. but you do see two characteristics of David that do also fit Psalm 3. The first one I just mentioned, and that is he's obviously in distress. But the second characteristic you see is that he is also displaying in this psalm courageous faith. And at the end of both psalms, he talks about being able to lie down and sleep. And so there are those similarities between these two psalms. What I would suggest to you, and this is just my opinion, but we all know my opinions are correct. Except at home. But I would suggest to you that the connection in the sense of the same setting with Psalm 3 is probably a little bit tenuous. because David's problem that he's talking about that's causing him stress, as we see it in Psalm 4, is a different problem. In Psalm 3, the problem is physical danger. Obviously, if they capture David and they win, David's life is going to be snuffed out. But in Psalm 4, and also in Psalm 3, he said thousands were arrayed against him. In other words, it wasn't just Absalom, it was his army that he had managed to raise as well. To the point that in verse 3 of Psalm 3, he starts out by saying, "Be a shield about me." And there is a lot of military terminology that we find in Psalm 3. Psalm 4, however, the problem is different. In Psalm 4, the problem is he is being attacked, but not physically. It's malicious slander that's being brought against him. And David's reputation is under attack. Now, I realize that happened to some extent with Absalom's revolt. You turn over to, I think, 2 Samuel 16, verse 6, you see the episode about the little guy named Shimei, who was a relative of King Saul's family. What Shimei was yelling at him, I wouldn't even call slander. But he's an example, and there may well have been other people who were slandering him. They might have not have been in Absalom's army, but they were back in Jerusalem slandering him. So it's possible that it's the same connection here. But what David is needing at this point in this psalm is not so much his physical safety, but he is wanting God's approval and his presence to surround him rather than physical deliverance. Now, the Psalms in general can be characterized in seven, and somebody going to correct me, needs to correct me, G-E-N-R-E, is that genre?
Genre.
Okay. There's seven genres that the Psalms in general can be broken down into, and I'm going to list them for you because they're not memorized. One is hymns. The second one is laments. The third one is thanksgiving. The fourth one is confidence. The fifth one is wisdom. The sixth one is remembrance. And the seventh one is kingship. And many of those are applied to the messianic type of kingship. But certainly we all know David was king. Now, Psalm 4 is a combination of two of these genres. One individual lament, and the second one confidence. And one might say that would be true also of Psalm 3. Now, Psalm 4 describes, and this is a little closer to where we are. Psalm 4 describes the anguish of being falsely accused and of being innocent of the things that are being said, the gossip and the slander. I could ask for a show of hands of how many have been besieged by an army of several thousand, but I would suspect that this one is much closer to where we live, in that it's an attack against him that is undeserved. And frankly, I said that, you know, he's innocent. Nobody is totally innocent. No one is totally righteous. Only the Lord Jesus Christ is totally righteous. Nevertheless, there are times when in relation to what's being said about him and the people who are saying it, David is innocent by comparison to what they're saying about him. And that's true of us, too, when people come against us. And let me just give you examples that you're probably familiar with. Somebody in the office wants to advance themselves at your expense. And then they start undermining your position in the office. You know, you're sitting there working and a secretary stops by your desk and says, "You should have heard what Miss So-and-so said about you yesterday." And then she proceeds to tell you whether you ask or not. And not only does she tell you, she embellishes on it. So that's the sort of thing that goes on. Should I ask for a show of hands? Any of you had a secretary tell you that? Here's one worse. Any of you been that secretary?
Don't raise your hand.
Okay. But again, the attacks are not physical. But the result is emotional harm, emotional hurt that can be agonizing, depending on what it's like. And the problem is we've all been through this kind of stress before. And frankly, this is something we need to be aware of. We are living in a culture that today is hostile toward Christians. And slander is something that you can expect is going to be increasing. It's already out there. I get frustrated with shows that Joan and I generally don't watch much television, and I stopped looking at the news after the Civil War. I did briefly look during World War I. I just wanted to see how the Allies were doing. But we like to watch mysteries.
Yes, me too.
We like to watch BBC mysteries. Uh-huh. But one of the problems is every time they present a Christian, he is a narrow-minded, judgmental
bigot.
Hypocrite. And if we find out later, he's committing the same sins he's judging everybody
right.
else for. Well, that's starting to have an impact on people. Mm-hmm. They're starting to see Christians like that. And the truth of the matter is, today, and in the culture that we live in, and this is not limited to the unbelieving world against Christians, but a disagreement with somebody's lifestyle or practice is not simply a disagreement from their perspective. It's you're full of hatred and you're a bigot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is something we're coming into.
Mm-hmm.
And so Psalm 4 has a pretty good application to us in terms of where all of us are likely to be. I don't want to be too negative, but usually this sort of hostility starts with slander and criticism, goes on to a deeper form of persecution. And some of you that have been on the mission fields are very aware of that sort of thing. Yeah, Ken?
Well, I mean, since we're talking about our experience of that, it strikes me odd when this happens because they hate me while accusing me of hating them.
Right.
They're committing the exact same offense, right?
Right?
Simultaneously, what they're really saying is, we recognize that you represent a much higher standard, but it turns out that you're just like me. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. I'm a sinner, messed up person just like you. The only difference between you and me is that I accept my sin and I recognize that someone's paid for that sin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the irony of all of this stuff. You know, you're accused of being what they're doing with you, but we make that mistake too as well. So that's the problem here. But that's something to be aware of, to be sensitive to.
Well, and Jerry, we the problem we have is we can't return evil for evil.
No.
The minute we return evil for evil, that's we've fallen into the trap. That's the challenge of overcoming evil with good is, you know, you have to love your enemies and they're going to come after you and they're going to attack you with words. And I think verse 4 gives us a remedy, and I know I'm running ahead, but it gives us a remedy of how do we deal with this? How do we process this?
Oh, yeah, it does.
In a sense, we have to deal with the problem. And, you know, unfortunately, our flesh will scream the old eye for an eye. But when we overcome evil with good, it's only because the power of the Holy Spirit is in us and is directing us. It's a guide. He's a guide.
Well, and the principles that we are going to see, and yes, you're right, they are in here. The principles we're going to see obviously apply on different levels.
Right.
When it's personal friend, and throughout the Psalms, periodically, we'll see David talk about a friend who stuck him in the back. You know, it says he ate my bread with me, and then he lifted up his heel against me. Or they speak to me as smooth as oil, but there's war in their hearts. So you can see that from the various Psalms that David is encountering this all along. We can encounter it on the personal level like that, and we can encounter it on a cultural level, like we're starting to see. But the principles are going to be the same on how you deal with it and what you do with it. And Jesus has already spoken to this, incidentally. And we're going to get to that in just a second. But what this psalm would be dealing with is when this is happening to you, how do we rise above it? What do we do about it? Now, in my case, what I do about it is I sue them. You know, slander's illegal. Well, the truth of the matter is, some Christians make the mistake of doing that. You know, a Christian, in my opinion, Christians should not, certain lawsuits should not be brought by Christians. And that's, there's a good number of them that shouldn't be, there's a good number of things a Christian shouldn't be suing over. Yeah, Polly.
Gary, isn't this the opportunity for learning what Jesus said on the cross? Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing.
There you go.
Yeah, I know you're talking to flesh screams, but that's what makes sense. Just forgive them.
Well, we're going to see that David did something very interesting in this psalm. I'm going to break it down into three categories, three groups. Verse 1 is an urgent plea to God for help in distress. I don't think there are any prayers in the Psalms that are ho-hum type prayers and duty prayers. I can't think of a psalm where the prayer wasn't urgent. And serious, the prayer was serious, and usually in a situation where he was urgent. That's the case here. Number two, this is verses 2-5. Now the first one was verse 1. Verses 2-5, a moving remonstrance. Anybody know what remonstrance means?
Rebuttal.
It's the repeat of monstrance.
We got that far.
In Hebrew, would you write that on the board for us? In Hebrew?
In Hebrew?
In remonstrance?
Yeah, in Hebrew it's yek.
Yek.
You knew he was not going to let that fly, right?
Here, remonstrance is a speaking to them, not rebuking exactly, but
it's a rebuttal.
It's a rebuttal. It's a wanting to get their attention, get them to understand something. Yeah, Kathy. What?
That's what he's doing.
Okay, she's doing this to me. But she means that to apply David's doing that to them. That would be a fair statement. Yeah.
Wagging the finger.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair definition. Now the and these remonstrance is addressed to his enemies. Now see, if you look in verse 2, he says, "O men, how long shall my honor be turned into shame?" Now, I used to see that that was God speaking to men. It's not. It's David speaking to those who are slandering him. Oh, men, how long shall my honor be turned into shame? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies? Now, this is ESV. I think, does anybody have NIV here?
I'm looking at it now.
Are you?
Paul Scott's. Is that what you mean?
I think NIV translates seeking false gods.
False gods.
All right. NIV says false gods instead of seek after lies. Similar, seeking after false god is seeking after a lie. But they are, in effect, accusing him and hitting him about his religious beliefs. And he is, as well as destroying his reputation. Now, section 3 is verses 6 through 8. And that is expressing his security in God, particularly verse 8, in peace I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. And one of the things that interests me too is the statement in verse 6, there are many who say, who will show us some good? And I would suggest we're living in a culture where more and more people are beginning to say that. And for us, it's an opportunity. More and more are finding out the philosophies of this age and acquiring lots of stuff and everything is empty. And they're starting to look around and say, who will show us anything good? And it's an opportunity for us. God lets cultures get in the mess they're in order to deliver as many as he can. He's not just saying nuts to you. He lets it happen. And we'll pick this up in Romans 1. You know, each time he says in Romans, from Romans 1, beginning in verse 18 to 32, he describes how they know who he is, but they deliberately refuse to acknowledge him and instead began to worship what David is saying here in NIV, other gods. And then it says, and God gave them over. In other words, he removed his restraint from them, and things got worse. And then the second time it says, and God gave them over. And this time it was sexual perversion and all that sort of thing. And things got even worse. And then the third time it says, and God gave them over again. Three times it says he gave them over, talking about society in particular. Yeah, what were you saying? Pharaoh?
I said it's kind of like what Pharaoh was doing every time there was a
he hardened his heart.
You know, Pharaoh, instead of realizing what God is doing, he hardens his heart, and God goes, okay, you want some more? Here you go.
And that's what we do. But if you read the last two verses of Romans 1, I think that's 31 and 32, you get this list. Does it start in 30 or 31? You get this list of how bad it is. And see if you see any application. Did you say something, Paula?
It looks like it starts in verse 29.
Okay. And I'm not going to have you read it. You can go read it. It'll ruin your lunch.
Yes, it will.
It's a list of vices, but you see just how bad it is.
Yeah.
Okay, why does God do that? Same reason we're going to see in verse 6 here. The more things get worse, and the worse they get, the more people are realizing this is a mess. And they start crying out, who will show us anything good? And so he allows these things to happen in order to save people, not to condemn them. But it's our own doing. And so he will use our own hands, the pit we dug, he'll let us fall into so that we'll cry out for help. That's in Psalm 7:15.
There's an old West Texas saying. It says, when you find yourself in a hole,
stop digging. My favorite West Texas saying is a Jesus statement in John 3. The wind blows and we know not where it comes from or where it goes. In the West Texas, they say, the wind bloweth where it blesseth, well listeth. Yeah, Tom. Let me get Tom. And I'll get you.
You had mentioned that some people thought that Psalms 4 might be related to the aftermath of Psalms 3. You
know? Could be, yeah.
Yeah, and I was just reading in 2 Samuel 19, verses 9 and 10, and somebody pointed out this to me recently, that after David won and Solomon was dead, there was arguing about what to do next. Here's what they said. Throughout the tribes of Israel, all the people were arguing among themselves, saying, the king, David, delivered us from the hands of our enemies, but he is the one who escaped. He is the one who rescued us from the hand of the Philistines, but now he has fled to the country to escape from Absalom. And Absalom, whom we have anointed to rule over us, now he has died in battle. So why do we say nothing about bringing the king back? So he was in exile, and they couldn't decide if they were going to bring him back or not. Sounded like to me.
In other words, a lot of different statements are being made about him.
Yeah. It was two sides.
It could be, yeah. There's no, you can't take a solid stand and say this is not related to Psalm 3, or it is. It could be. We just don't know.
To that part of it where a lot of people were saying, we don't want him back. You know, we want somebody.
Okay.
Who,
okay. That's a good point.
There's a lot of talking going on.
Yeah, Psalm 3, which we saw, was written on the second day that David fled, the second day of Absalom's revolt. Psalm 4 could have been written at the end of that revolt after they had had a victory over them. So, yeah, that's a good point. I'm open to anything on that because we just don't know for sure. But the danger, the problem here is different from the problem with Absalom. And it's a problem, as I've said earlier, that many of us are likely, if not already, have encountered and wanting to, because you can be hurt deeply when you hear secondhand, especially what somebody may have said about you. And unfortunately, most people, instead of confronting, because that's something we don't like to do, especially if the hurt has come from another Christian, instead of confronting, they back off and break fellowship, which Jesus expressly told us not to do, because that breaks the unity of the church. But the enemy loves to sow false statements among the believers because people get hurt, they get offended. Instead of doing what they should do, what Scripture tells them, they back off because they don't want to confront.
Right.
Yeah, and I get that. I don't like confronting either. Unless I'm being paid for it. That's different. Yeah, it's one thing to confront in the courthouse. It's another thing to confront face-to-face, personally, when you're the one that's involved, and so are they. But the enemy uses this sort of stuff to do damage to the church and to create disunity in the church. Now, because of verse 8, let's go back to verse 8 of Psalm 4. In peace, I will both lie down and sleep. In other words, he's not going to let what people said about him keep him awake. And we do that, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
We rehearse it over and over in our minds. And it's so helpful to do that.
Oh, yeah. It magnifies it.
You know, yeah, you need to build up the resentment before you go after them.
It helps you sleep a lot.
It does.
Yeah.
You sleep so much better when you do that. Yeah. He has found a secret that we want to look at that allows him, after this sort of thing has happened, to lie down and sleep. And I mean sleep. I don't mean toss and turn and thinking about it and changing your position in the bed and trying to do something to get to sleep. But he has found something we want to look at. Incidentally, it's because of that statement, in peace I will lie down and sleep. Psalm 4 is called an evening psalm. Now, Psalm 3 is called a morning psalm because he lays down and sleep and gets up with confidence. So 8:48 is at night as he's going to bed, and I think it's 3:6 or 7. It's 5. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustains me. So morning psalm, evening psalm. Yeah, John.
I think that verse 8 really is a delightful outgrowth for the start of verse 7.
Okay.
You have put more joy in my heart than they have when they're drained of wine. That is
fill their hearts. It's easy to go to sleep.
Yeah, what you get there also, and I'm glad you brought that up, what you get there, notice what the comparisons are. You've put more joy in my heart than they have when their grain and wine abound. In other words, a joy that's based on financial provision or material benefit. His joy is supernaturally imparted. And he is showing that the joy that comes from the Lord is far better than the joy and happiness we get from earthly pleasures and earthly benefits, you know, earthly material goods.
It's like a demonstration of don't be drunk with wine, instead be filled with the
Holy Spirit. Okay, good.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Ephesians 5:18. Go ahead.
I said it's just kind of like bringing it to life that don't be drunk with wine, but instead be filled with the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Ephesians 5:18, and Paul's about to go into the Spirit-filled life, starting with verse 18. And he talks about singing songs and hymns, etc., to one another. Yeah, Les?
Yeah, this just shows the agricultural society that they
Good.
Live in, and that's their point, their example of the greatest joy that they can experience.
Yeah, good. Yeah, good point. And you see it's just such an interesting comparison of where real value lies and where the real joy is. And of course, in their case, their joy. In other words, he says, "I have more joy than they have." In other words, they have joy, but their joy is situational.
Right.
The joy that comes from the Lord is not situational. It doesn't depend on what's going on around you to function. And my favorite way of explaining that is you get a letter from IRS and it says, we're giving you a $500 refund. And you've got joy. You get another letter from IRS that says, we are checking into your taxes.
Yeah.
We are going to do an audit. No joy.
No joy.
But God's joy doesn't depend on that. God's joy functions. That's why Paul in Philippians had joy in the Roman prison in Rome. Yeah. Okay, go ahead. And then John will get you.
What you're explaining, I think, and what David's speaking to here is the distinction between happiness and joy. Happiness is based on circumstances. Joy is something much deeper. It's based on a promise or a hope that is realized in spite of circumstances.
Okay, my favorite description of joy is in Nehemiah. The joy of the Lord is our strength.
Mm-hmm. The joy of who? The Lord.
The Lord.
It's not ours, it's His.
And I can tell you something, when you get hit with that joy, it does strengthen you. It is something.
It's supernatural.
Yeah, it strengthens you when you get hit with that joy. John, did you have something? Okay. All right. Let's look at
Jerry. I think that it's just really important for us to focus on the fact that where that joy comes from is from Him. You see the creativity of God because He puts the joy in our hearts. And for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. I mean, just like it was, don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Holy Spirit. That last part is, He makes me lie down in green pastures.
Okay,
He gives me. The peace comes after the joy.
Okay.
He's the creator of all of it. And as we recognize it and walk in it, it's something that we can rest in.
Okay.
Hey, Ron, is joy a good thing?
Yes.
Where do all good things come from?
God. There you go.
Let me, Marty and Louise, I passed you over. I'm sorry. I'll get Marty speaking and I'll.
I think it all comes from where our focus is.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know?
Okay.
If our focus is on the Lord, then we get our joy from Him, our strength from Him, all of that, and we don't take offense because otherwise, if we put our focus on what's going on, to me, then it's easy, you know, focus is on myself, then or this other situation, whatever, then it's impossible. You know?
Well, we're back to Psalm 3.
Yeah.
David took his focus off the crisis and put it on the Lord. And of course, what we were looking at is how do you do that? Okay, this again in this psalm is a shift in focus. And what we want to see is how he did that. It's a different shift than what we saw in Psalm 3. So, yeah, Louise.
Oh, in Isaiah 54, now correct me if I'm wrong about that one. There it says, no weapon that is formed against
me prosper.
That'll if you're asking me, Daddy, know that God's talking to you, peace comes. You may think you may be going through the hell of having this done. By the way, this works both ways now.
Yep.
You do that to somebody else, that same promises to them. But I take that one so many times, and we can, and it brings peace, joy, whatever comes, that eventually, that whenever prosper against you, eventually God will step in and do something.
Yeah, in fact, a good one is Romans 8:31 that's going to apply here, but I'll go ahead and give it now. If God be for you, who can be against you? That's right, and this is going to apply in David's situation. Yeah, Camille.
I was just going to say that we think of the green pastures and that kind of security, but you know, God's people a lot of times are sleeping outside with their head on a rock. And they seem to be able to find the same security.
Yeah, yeah. It's
not in the circumstance.
It's the spirit. It's the walk with the spirit. I've told you before that Mark 1 shows us that the walk with Jesus is a walk through the wilderness. Because Satan got control of the world and he destroyed not only Adam and Eve, but he destroyed the Garden of Eden and turned the world into a wilderness. But I'm not saying literally destroyed it in the sense of burning it down. But Satan turned the world into a wilderness.
Correct.
Yeah, you had your hand. Did you have your hand?
Me, yes. I have an Amplified version, and the verse 8, it says safety and confident trust.
Okay, good.
So, and I like that because we do have to have confident trust that, you know, then we have peace that God's got it. We don't have to try to fix it or handle it.
Yeah, I like the Amplified. It's good. You ever read the Amplified version on the Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star?
No.
It's Twinkle.
Here it comes.
This is Twinkle, Twinkle. That is flicker, illuminate, star. That is gaseous body.
Doesn't smell as well, huh?
But I do like the Amplified. It can be very helpful. Yeah, I can. Let's just take prayer requests and go on.
I think so. What is that promise? No weapon formed against us can ever prosper. But what does it mean to prosper against us? I mean, there are Christians in Afghanistan right now being slaughtered. In the Sudan, they're being beheaded. Their children are enslaved, and they're Christians. And frequently what happens, there are stories coming out of these countries constantly of where they are being told to recant Christ, and they happily do not. They happily accept the sword.
That's right.
The promise is not for the abundance of grain and wine. The promise is for an eternity with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
That's the promise.
And that's and where the joy comes from. Yeah,
and so what we often do is say, how can God be in this? Look how difficult my circumstance is.
Because we're living in the circumstances.
Well, the point is not this life, but the next one. You live for that life in this life and bring as many people with you as you can. That's the whole point. That's the war.
Yeah, it's like so many people, it's like being on board the Titanic. Instead of getting as many into the lifeboats as you can, you're playing shuffleboard one more game. Yes, ma'am.
I was going to say another reason that I see that no weapons will come against you, that are formed against you, prosper, is because, like you're saying, even though they are being slaughtered, there's purpose. Like, it's an awful atrocity that death is, but like God is using that for purpose. And it turns people for ash, so it's not purposeless.
Mm-hmm.
So it cannot prosper because God turns
the
like ashes
into
beauty.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Cannot defeat God's
purpose. Pardon?
It cannot defeat God's purpose.
Correct. Yeah. You
know, what we think of, you know, these Christians that are being prosecuted, persecuted, and condemned. I just read something about a brother who came to know the Lord. He was Muslim, and he's leading, the Lord is using him to lead many of the Tuareg to the Lord. At one point, he was being confronted by these guys that were coming to kill you. And what he said is, I know what we think of, oh no, here I am, if I was this guy, I'm gonna die. And he said, I have great joy. I'm not worried. And I think what happens, we don't know this, I can't say this for everybody, but I believe that when this believer stands up, God fills him with tremendous joy, strength, and he can go right to the pit, to the, you know, had his head cut off or whatever, and God really responds, strengthening him. And I think these guys see this, you know, these people that hate the Christians, they see this, and this has an impact on some.
Well, it does.
Acts 7, Stephen. Yeah,
it does. It has tremendous impact.
Stephen's
because
a great
people
example.
Say, when they start saying, who will show us any good? And that's an example of seeing it. Then they start saying, what have you got that I don't have?
Well,
if you read anything like the Fox's Book of Martyrs,
yep.
You'll find that they were impacting the people in the stands of the arenas where they were being. And people, you know, a lot of them were shouting and screaming and yelling to kill them. But there were lots of people there that were quietly watching that and being impacted and would find their way down into the catacombs, mm-hmm. including gladiators, asking how to be, to know Christ. So
right.
God uses all of
yes.
that stuff to accomplish his
sure.
purposes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Revelation 12:11 says, and they conquered him, meaning the devil, by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. When we get to that place where we understand the perspective of eternity, and we understand that this isn't home, then we understand that the value isn't here, it's there. And I think that's what we're talking about, is the fact that we have to be able to see that. It's like what Gary was talking about this morning with his, you know, there was this guy. The perspective is, how do you see it? How do you understand it? Because if we're focused on the Lord and not on the circumstances that are here, like Stephen, I mean, Stephen had two places to look. He could look at the guys who were stoning him, or he could look into heaven, and Jesus is standing up to receive him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which picture do you want? Okay.
Yeah.
You can take either one of them, but I think that's our challenge, is the lesson of,
well,
how do we look at it?
Keep in mind, verse 6 here in Psalm 4 is the doorway into
right.
what we've been talking about. It is the realization that what comes from God is what's important. Paul says the same thing in 2 Corinthians 4:18, while we look not at the scene, but at the unseen.
There you go.
For that which is seen is transient, but that which is unseen is eternal. Now that's a doorway here in verse 6 into what he's saying. And, you know, all that we've been talking about in the last few minutes, that coming through the door of verse 6 because of the comparison between the eternal and the temporary. And that's, in a sense, it's not that obvious when you look at it, but in a sense, that is what he is suggesting. Now, let me get the, am I missing anybody? Let me get to you.
I was just, as we were talking, I was thinking about a story I read about a secret service agent in Russia that were persecuting the Christians. He went into this house, and while they were grabbing them, this one lady prayed for him. He didn't know what to do. He left.
Yeah.
You know what? He ended up accepting the Lord actually, and he even ended up in the States. He escaped and all this. What kind of interesting story. But God used, she, as Pastor Gary was saying, she was blessing this person that was hurting and all these other guys. She was blessing him, asking God. And that's the perfect example of what Gary said, but also something that I did hear where it was, I know that that man was transformed because the obedience of this young woman being beaten and hauled out to be persecuted. Yeah.
What people don't realize a lot is that in the Russian army, there were lots of Christian soldiers. And when Russia invaded Afghanistan, many of the Christian Russian soldiers wound up leading many Afghanis to Christ. So, see, God accomplishes things apart from the way we evaluate them. Yeah. Now, let me get to the, I'm getting the buzz here. It's 11:55, which means, it's tempting to stop here, but I do want us to look at, let's see, do I or don't I? Hard question. I might just get into it a little bit. Verses 2 through 5 is the really the significant middle, the guts of this thing. And that is, he says, O men, how long shall my honor be turned into shame? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. Be angry and do not sin. Ponder in your own hearts on your beds and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and put your trust in the Lord. Who's he talking to?
Those who hate him.
He is talking to the people that are slandering him. He is telling him, notice what he's saying. Be angry and do not sin. Ponder in your own hearts on your beds and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and put your trust in the Lord. And of course, Lord there is Yahweh, capital L, capital O-R-D. So, and go back up, and he says, but know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself, for the Lord hears when I call to him. I would suggest to you that David is praying for these people. That's the secret of rising above it. Because what we're going to see is, as David prayed for them, David is changed. That's how he's able to lie down and sleep. As he prays for his enemies, he's changed. Now, there again is something that seems the opposite of what it should be, like all everything else we've been talking about. Now, who do we know that has said that?
Stephen, Jesus.
Yeah, let's go over to Luke 6.
That reminds me of the beatitude that every day. You know, Jesus told us to pray for all enemies. And this is what we call it, because you don't have to go out as, you know, a spider was born on. We've got to go out because we're soldiers of the Lord. And we're going into the enemy's camp. So therefore, they are going to come against us. They are going to persecute us and everything. But Jesus is our shield. We overcome by the blood of the Lamb and the word of our testimony and everything. The word of God is our testimony. We can see time and time again how God brings us out, how he delivers our loved ones. God is moving, you know, through his gift, and he's blessing us to go forward in life and to be a witness for him and to show forth his praises, to, you know, to let him be known. And it's not a silent thing. And he don't want us to be ashamed of him and everything, and not to be afraid of your enemy, because your enemy is defeated. but we got to go forward so God can manifest his glory.
And he said, declare his glory among the heathen, his marvelous works among all nations.
So we got to go forward. That's just like being in the military. We are trained to kill our enemy. Of course, not to, you know, go out and shoot someone. But we are trained that way to go forward in the enemy's camp and go head on and not be afraid that we have to go, you know, and share Jesus everywhere we go. And we met God to bring along deliverance for his people and those who are going against us. Somebody might be saved.
One of the great things about God's military is that he has tremendous retirement benefits.
There you go. Well, and in our perception of the battle, Jerry, we don't understand, you know, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. And we don't understand that the people sometimes that are yelling and screaming at us are just prisoners of war.
Oh, yeah.
And if we look at them as the enemy, mm-hmm. we've missed the boat. Mm-hmm. Our enemy is the enemy, mm-hmm. and they are but prisoners. And so if we look at it that way, then we can have compassion on them and love them in a way that I don't think we can love them if we just look at the circumstances.
Paul says, and one of you quoted it earlier in Romans 12:21, but overcome evil with good. In other words, what precedes that is don't return evil for evil.
Right.
Because that's what we normally want to do. But on the contrary, victory lies in overcoming evil with good. And Jesus says this, he says in verse 24 of Luke 6, and then we'll shut it down, and I'll decide whether there's anything further we need to do in Luke, Psalm 4. I realize that's breaking a precedent, but we may not need to stay in verse 4, because this is the guts of verse 4 right here. How do you focus, how do you adjust your focus in this kind of context? And what constitutes the lifting of my head as he asked God to do for him in Psalm 3:3? Jesus says this, but woe to you, he says, but I say to you, verse 27, I'm sorry, not 24, but I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. To one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also, and from one who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic. Now, this is a description of Romans 12:21. This is what we're talking about when we say overcome evil with good. And it says, and do not demand your goods back, and as you wish that others would do to you, do so to them. If you love those who love you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful even as your Father is merciful. This is something that David discovered. In loving his enemies, he prayed for them, that they would come to this understanding. In the process of doing that, he was changed. David was changed. Now, hopefully, his enemies will change too eventually. But David was changed because I would suggest to you that in doing that, he short-circuited any desires to be resentful, angry, and hateful. So, this is a very interesting psalm. And I read it for years and never realized that who he was talking about was not God talking about them. It was David praying for them mm-hmm. to God. Mm-hmm. And the impact was, I'm able to lie down and sleep. Mm-hmm. I don't stay awake all night thinking about the dirty things they said about me. And so he has short-circuited bad emotions that would rise up. Remember, in Psalm 37, he says, dismiss fury, dismiss anger. For anger, let me get it. So those who are angry will be cut off. Let me get that real quick. I'll retell the story I've told you before about that verse. But it says, refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself. It tends only to evil. That's verse 8, verse 9. For the evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land. Now, I've told the story before numerous times. Well, not numerous times, but some of you may not have heard it. The rest of you that have, you just put your heads down and sleep. But when I was a divorce lawyer, that's why I have the color hair I do. I've had this since I was 29. Because that is one of the most gut-wrenching areas of law you can practice. Because people are suffering terribly from rejection, from all kinds of things. And during the course of that, I had three men that I represented who, as a result of a knockdown, drag-out, ugly, nasty divorce, were full of anger and resentment for what had been done to them, they said, behind their back, and for things that were being said about them. And I should have given them Psalm 4 if I'd known to do that. But they were full of anger. And so what in each case, with each of these men, I turned them to Psalm 37, and I read those two verses to them. And the other quality that they had was bitterness, deep bitterness, because that's where anger and resentment go. And it's destructive of the soul, but it's also destructive of the body, because it says, we'll be cut off. And I said to each one of them, if you don't deal with this and learn to forgive, it'll kill you. Each of those men were dead within a year after I told them.
Please never say that to me.
Stay away from bitterness and I won't. Yeah. Two of them heart attacks, one of them cancer. So believe me, God knows what he's talking about when he says these things. Okay, we need to stop.